On Tuesday, one of the authors of a headline-grabbing study published in December in the leading journal Science called for a retraction of his own work. The study claimed that a 20-minute face-to-face conversation with a gay canvasser could very often change someone's mind about gay marriage. So often, noted an editor at Science, that, quote, the magnitude of the shift for the person who answered the door was as large as the difference between attitudes in Georgia and Massachusetts. The study's astonishing findings were widely reported in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vox, This American Life. Here's Ira Glass.
And the big surprise was, 6 months, 9 months, a year after the canvassers visited, the voters stayed changed. The researchers were so skeptical that this could be real that they did the entire study a second time. At huge cost, by the way, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And again, same result. Professor Green says he and his colleagues have read 900 papers and they haven't seen anything like this result. Anyone who's changed people's views and it lasted like this.
But when two graduate students, David Brookman and Joshua Kalla, tried to replicate the results, they found some worrisome red flags in the data. That prompted one of the study's co-authors, Donald Green, a Columbia University professor, to get the original data from his co-author, UCLA graduate student Michael LaCour. Green wanted to examine it, which he hadn't prior to publication, but LaCour didn't provide it. So Green asked Science to retract the study. Ivan Oransky is the co-founder of Retraction Watch, and he says those results should have been the first tip-off.
The idea that you could convince anyone of anything in this day and age is actually quite remarkable.
So what were the problems with the study that these graduate students found?
They actually were very taken with the study. One of them said, you know, I'm gay, and this is something that I think about a lot, and I wanted to believe this study. I also, he said, wanted to replicate it and then do the next step in the experiment. So he starts looking at the data. They're remarkable. The response rate.
Something like 90%?
Yeah, you don't get 90% in surveys. And just the magnitude of how they were able to shift, again, from Georgia to Massachusetts, it was pretty dramatic. And so that raised some red flags.
And then they found that the data were distributed over a pattern that could be easily generated by a computer program.
Correct. And this is how cheaters are caught in science. It looked funny. It looked too perfect. Then they dug further and said, well, let's look at how this was actually obtained. And when they called the survey company that had allegedly done the work, they said, we don't have anybody by that name here, and we don't do that kind of work.
I think it's pretty clear why Michael LaCour may have cooked this thing up. He was at the beginning of his career. He wanted to make a splash, and there isn't a way to make a bigger splash than to publish a paper in a journal like Science.
LaCour gave us the same statement that he gave lots of other news organizations and hasn't really responded to any questions in a substantive way. So I don't want to read his mind here, but if you look at the timeline, it's pretty clear that here's a guy who's out there looking for a job, and this would have been the time, December-ish, when he would have been out on the road applying for jobs, which he, according to the Princeton University website, did get at Princeton. But the pressure to publish, it's not far-fetched to say he was feeling that.
The motivation that isn't so clear to me is that of his co-author, Professor Green at Columbia. It strikes me that his failure to look at the original data and the excuse he gives for it just doesn't wash.
His rationale for not having looked at the data was that essentially, if you do research involving humans, which surveying them, particularly if you're trying to change their mind, is, then you need to get what's known as Institutional Review Board approval. And this is for good reason. This has been around about 40 years here in the U.S., protects human subjects. But someone had already given IRB approval for this, UCLA. Green could have easily sort of said to Columbia, here's what I want to do, is it okay? Or give me some sort of appointment at UCLA for 15 minutes so I can do that. Whatever it would be, there are lots of ways around that. But often what happens is people put their names on papers, and then when the proverbial hits the fan, they disown any knowledge of it. Well, I didn't do that part of the paper. And to be fair, Green is giving a rationale for why he didn't look at it, but he's the one who's actually sort of coming forward here and, I think, doing the right thing.
So let's talk about peer review. As you've noted, this is a volunteer, unpaid position. I think that situations like this make a very strong argument for actually paying peer reviewers, because anybody could have done what those graduate students did, which was to call up the place that generated the data, especially if it looked a little fishy.
If you talk to Science Journal editors about it, they say, there's no way for us to have found that, no way for peer reviewers to have found that, but it rings a bit hollow because, as you point out, anyone could have called the place that allegedly did this survey. That probably would have been going beyond what is reasonable given that peer reviewers are unpaid, it's a volunteer activity, and they don't have that much time.
Well, in that case, they shouldn't be doing the peer reviewing.
So who should?
Pay them money and pay them by the hour.
I'm not against that. On the other hand, they would still need access to more information than they currently have, and they need more time to do it. We've seen a case, a study in Cell, came out about 2 years ago, cloning human embryonic stem cells. They missed all of these really problematic figures that were in the paper, which ended up having to get corrected. The people who caught that were not the peer reviewers, because the peer reviewers had said, at the request of the journal, we will do this in 24 hours. Now, imagine that. Those errors were found within days of the paper's publication.
Okay, now let's look at the journalists. We assume that once it's gone through the peer review process, we can trust it. You think, you know, not so fast.
What I tell my students at NYU, where I teach medical journalism, is you should keep a biostatistician in your back pocket. I think they're wonderful people. They tend to be somewhat lonely people. That's, of course, not fair. But having worked with them, it was so valuable because they could rip these studies apart, find out what was wrong, give me the questions to ask at the very least. Because in this case, really, no one raised very many red flags. That was actually somewhat amazing to me.
You think that the entire scientific/journalism establishment had confirmation bias when it came to this study?
Yeah. When studies show something that we sort of believe is true or want to be true, which is probably even more pernicious than believe is true, we tend to sort of go along with it. This is why, to us, the argument really should be about post-publication peer review. Do some preliminary peer review, but let it out in the world and accept that just because it's published in Science or Nature or New England Journal of Medicine, it still probably has flaws that more eyeballs will find.
But it's already made its impact on the world, and it's much harder to make a counter-impact with a correction.
John Maddox was the editor-in-chief of Nature, and the reporter was trying to be a little provocative. He said, John, how much of what you publish every week in Nature, again, world's leading scientific journal, how much of it is wrong? And Maddox said, oh, that's easy, all of it. And what he meant was, over time, all of it would be proven wrong, with a couple exceptions. The bigger problem in science is not so much the fraud. It's this lack of reproducibility. But it is very much an epidemic in science right now. If you look at cancer studies, for example, as many as 90% of studies that are licensed into drug companies are not reproducible. That's the much bigger problem. If this gets everyone thinking about that, and if it makes a single reporter think twice about covering a study without any skepticism next time, we've accomplished something.
Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great. Always great to be here.
Ivan Oransky is Vice President and Global Editorial Director at MedPage Today, the co-founder of Retraction Watch, and a doctor who teaches medical journalism at NYU.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.